Well, beloved, we come to the end of a journey, and that journey is this particular feast that we've been looking at now for several weeks, the Feast of First Fruits. And in order to appreciate and understand the Feast of First Fruits, we had to spend some time considering, number one, how the Jews reckon time. And that goes all the way back to Genesis chapters 1 and the creation week. The evening and the morning were the first day. Evening and the morning was the second day. And so as the Old Testament unfolds and as you read your Old Testament, we learn that the Jews reckoned time by the day beginning in the evening at 6 o'clock in the evening, on or around that time frame, and ending 6 o'clock the following evening as well. Evening to evening, sundown to sundown, okay? You get that in your mind, and you're gonna help as far as understanding time as it was accounted or reckoned in the Old Testament, and even in the New Testament times, as you see the four Gospels unfolding in the life of Christ. So the nighttime portion of the day came first, and then the day would conclude with the daylight hours. And then it would terminate when the sun went down on or around 6 o'clock in the evening, okay? And so therefore, when you look at the week in which Jesus died, now we're coming up on Easter next month, in April this year. And so the idea of Good Friday to Sunday morning that you normally hear about the crucifixion on Friday, and then Sunday morning the tomb was found empty. Beloved, that's not 3 days and three nights. I don't care how you want to cut it, how you want to dance a jig, it's not going to work. Because when you read the four Gospels, and when you come to John's Gospel, chapter 19, and again, this chart that I'm referring to is on the church website, so you can follow along. But in John chapter 19, John is the only one that tells us the day following the Passover, the day after Jesus is crucified, died, and buried, that next day is not the weekly Sabbath, but a high Sabbath. It was the first day of unleavened bread. And that's where many students of the Bible, many commentators, go out to lunch. They fail to realize that Jesus died on a Wednesday in the middle of the week. And the very next day at 6 o'clock Wednesday, as Jesus was being buried and as the sun was going down, that began Thursday. And that day was a high Sabbath. No work was to be done. It was a holy convocation, okay? And it began the first of 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That goes all the way back to Exodus, when the Israelites were set free by the Lord, allowing Pharaoh to basically expel them out of his land. And then, 3 days and 3 nights and 3 days later, you have the weekly Sabbath, okay? That's the traditional Sabbath, 6 days of work, 1 day rest, okay? And then on the seventh day, or the eighth day of the week, if you will, or the first day of the week, the women come to the tomb, and they discover the tomb is empty. Ironically, that particular day is the Feast of First Fruits. And I read to you in the past couple of weeks what that was. It was the first harvest of their agricultural cycle in the month of April, Abib. Now the word Nisan, sometimes you find that word in the Bible, Nisan, that's the Babylonian version of the word Abib, or the month April. Abib, Nisan, same month, one is Jewish, one is Babylonian, as far as its name, okay? And so that's when the very first sheaves of barley, the choicest sheaves, were harvested out from the fields, brought into the temple, and waved before the Lord. And we read that in the last hour in Leviticus, where they're still in the wilderness. They're still transitory. They're not in the land yet. But God tells them, when you eventually get in the land, we're going to add another feast in that 1 week. You have the Passover. You have the first day of unleavened bread. You're going to have the weekly Sabbath. And then the day after the Sabbath, as you read in the Gospels, is the Feast of First Fruits, where the concept of first fruits and firstborn tied together, God gets the first, God gets the very best, God doesn't get the crumbs, he doesn't get the leftovers that we hide in the fridge for several days, he gets the choicest cut of meat, he gets the choicest of our vigor, the choicest of our energy, of our mind, of our talents, of our abilities. We give him the very best of ourselves to his service. In whatever calling that you're in, post hole digger, doctor, nurse, lawyer, housewife, dishwasher, you give him the very best in that endeavor. All work is sacred. No such thing as secular work, beloved. All work is sacred. Even Adam had a job in the garden, and that was to till the garden, take care of the garden, be the custodian of that Garden of Eden. Even Adam had work in paradise. So work is good. The only thing now that makes work a drudgery is the curse of sin. In the last hour, we considered this concept of first. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all your heart, mind, soul, body, all of your energy, all of you. And in the New Testament, Jesus was confronted by the Pharisees on one occasion. Hey, Jesus, what's the greatest commandment? And Jesus gives them right back Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, the Shema. Every Jew could quote that front and back and from the middle. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all your heart, mind, soul, body, spirit, all of your energy, all of you. God gets the first. And the second is like unto the first, love your neighbor as thyself. And on this, Jesus says, the law and the prophets swing like a door on its hinges. Well, in this hour, we're going to discover some beautiful things in Old Testament history that occurred exactly on this particular day. Now, in order for you to appreciate this, our church secretary has also placed on the church website, in conjunction with this series, a calendar. A calendar. Now, when you read Exodus chapter 12, and please hear me carefully, because I don't want to be confusing. I don't want to muddle the water. When you go to Exodus chapter 12, let's go ahead and go there first. Exodus chapter 12. Notice what God tells Moses to tell the people, that there is a change coming to the calendar. To the calendar. And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month, okay, this month, Exodus 12, verse 2, this month shall be unto you the beginning of months. Literally, the beginning of your year. Now, in the Old Testament, you will find two calendars in use and in operation. The Jews had what was called a civil calendar. A civil calendar. All right? Trying to get my notes here. A civil calendar. Under that calendar, the first month was in the September-October time frame, the month Tishri. Tishri was the first month of the civil calendar. Okay? First month. But in the religious calendar, it was the seventh month. And so I would highly recommend that you either go online, Google, or maybe you have a Bible dictionary or a good Bible reference study reference Bible that has the comparison between the civil calendar and the religious calendar. The religious calendar for the Jews begins here in Exodus 12. The month Abib, Hebrew, Nisan, Babylonian, is in the month of April. In the month Abib, corresponding to our month, April. Okay? So, in the Jewish calendar, when it comes to the religious calendar, that calendar begins in the month of April. Now, our calendar, the Julian or Gregorian calendar, we begin the new year when? 1 January, New Year's Day. When you check ancient civilizations, ancient cultures, you will find that they began their new year, ironically, in the spring, when things begin to bud, things begin to come alive again. The winter is past. New life is emerging from the ground and on the trees. So many ancient civilizations began their new year in the spring of the year. Not like in January, the way we do today. Just like when it comes to reckoning when a new day begins. Under Hebrew reckoning, it was sundown to sundown. That encompassed one day. And our reckoning of time, it's what? Midnight to midnight reckons one day to the next day. And because of that, there's a lot of confusion. Especially when you come to the Passion Week, where you have this Roman Catholic concept of Good Friday to Sunday morning somehow applying itself to the 3 days and three nights that Jesus was going to be in the heart of the earth. Okay? And it says there, it shall be the first month of the year to you. So this is when God begins and gives to Israel a new reckoning of time, which we call the religious calendar that the Hebrews guided their religious festivals. The civil calendar that you also find running through the Old Testament was used for business transactions, the birthing or like a birth certificate, the registering of a birth of a child, and the reckoning of when a king began his reign. So the civil calendar applied to, well, governmental administrative type things, while the religious calendar focused exclusively on these feasts that Israel as a people were to observe. Okay? Now, once again, listen carefully. Under the religious calendar, the month Abib is the first month of the year. Under the civil calendar, the month Abib is the seventh month. I'll say that once again because I don't want to muddle the water. Because when I start showing you these historical events, hold on, Pastor, you're saying number one, but you're saying it's number seven? Under the religious calendar, Abib, i.e. April, is the first month. But under the civil calendar that you find in operation, especially before Exodus 12, it's the seventh month. Okay? Do I have that at least in your minds? All right. Now, watch the beauty of Old Testament history. And what this first fruits represents two things: salvation and resurrection. You got that? Good. First example, turn to Genesis 8. Genesis chapter 8. Now, when you read the account of the flood of Noah, I remember reading someplace that the chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9 almost reads like a ship's captain's log. If you're ever on board a ship, a captain that is in charge of a ship has to keep a very meticulous diary, if you will. On a particular day, at a particular time, he'll give a weather forecast. He'll log down the temperature. He'll give you the whether the sea was calm or whether it was rough, whether there was wind or no wind, whether they were going through a gale or whether they were going through placid water, just like a sheet of glass, all right? And if there was any kind of commotions on the ship, if something needed to be fixed, all that would be logged, like a diary, very, very meticulous. And when you read the account of Noah's flood, beloved, it reads just like a captain's log. You have to almost kind of stand amazed. To me, it's almost as if, well, Noah was the captain. And he's the one, I believe, that was recording the events. Look at Genesis chapter 7, verse 11, for instance. Now, we know that Moses wrote the first five books. I also believe that Moses did have in his possessions things that were written down by those who came well before him and were kept in safekeeping. I believe that there were written records on board the ark that outlines all the history that we read in the first five chapters of Genesis. I believe Noah had in his possessions a written record of what was going on in that antediluvian world. And when he left the ark, those records, those written records of history, came off the ark with him. And it wouldn't surprise me if Moses had access to that. But notice the ship's captain's log. Remember Star Trek? In the year so-and-so, such-and-such, you had that captain's log being mentioned by Captain Kirk. Well, look at verse 11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up and the windows of heaven were open. Well, beloved, that forms a captain's log. He's telling you on a specific day, okay, on a specific day, this occurred. Now drop down to 7 verse 24. And the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. So once again, Noah enters a ship's log diary. He enters an event. Now drop all the way down to chapter 8 and verse 3. And the waters returned from off the earth continually, and after the end of the 150 days, the waters were abated, and the ark rested in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the mountains of Ararat. Passover's the 14th, seventh month, that's the old calendar. What was the seventh month in the old calendar? Abib, first month of the religious calendar. Passover's the 14th, Thursday would be the 15th, Friday the 16th, Saturday, 17th, Feast of First Fruits would then begin. Notice that when the ark came to rest on the mountains, it was in the month of April. On the 17th day. First fruits. What does that day represent? Two things. Salvation, resurrection. Noah plus seven and all the animals came through saved. Resurrection, How do you get that in there, preacher? From 8 people, all humanity would be resurrected as people propagating on the planet. Salvation and resurrection together on 8 and 4. And the waters decrease continually, verse 5, until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, were the tops of the mountain seen. Verse 5 of chapter 8. Notice the ship's log that Noah kept meticulously. It was on the very day, the 17th day of the 7th month, using the original calendar, which began in the fall. October would have been the first month. You count 7 months. The 7th month would be the month corresponding to Abib, the month of April, the 17th day. Beloved, that's the day the tomb would be found empty. And thus Jesus being first fruits of those who slept, never to die again. Wonder of wonders, wonder of wonders. The tomb was found empty the same day back in ancient history when the Ark of Noah rested on Ararat, saving all 8 and all the animals, and starting a new beginning with a new world and a new mankind coming forth from the 3 sons of Noah. I find that no accident, but a providential marker for us to behold. I find that to be simply awesome. Let me share with you another one. Israel's departure. Stop and think. Stop and think. This week that's being reenacted in the life of Jesus harkens all the way back to Exodus 12, right? Passover. The night when all the fathers put the blood on the doorpost and lintels. Then they were told to scram, get out of Egypt. What was the very next day? First, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Well, notice, count. 3 days later, they're still trekking, and it's still within the 7 days, first fruits. A picture of the nation, what? Resurrecting itself out of Egypt to become a covenant people, and salvation. They were delivered in the same time period that these 3 feasts would be replicated in Jewish history, even into the life of Jesus, which he himself, as Passover lamb, reenacted for us. Israel of old and the greater Israel takes the same journey that the old Israel took in the wilderness. Turn with me to Exodus 13. Now remember, back in Exodus chapter 12, we were told that the month Abib would be the beginning of months, and that would be April, starting with the Passover, okay? Well, look at Exodus chapter 13, verses 1 to 4. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, sanctify unto me all the firstborn. So, beloved, they're now out of the land. They're beginning their wandering to the land of Midian, to the foot of Mount Sinai, okay? And yet they're going to have to cross the Red Sea in order to get across the sea into the land of Midian and to get to Mount Sinai, all right? So while they're leaving Egypt, God tells Moses, oh, by the way, as you guys begin your journey, I want you to set apart unto me all the firstborn, whosoever opened at the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and of beast. And Moses said unto the people, remember this day. They're coming on the heels of that Passover night. So they're beginning to leave Egypt on that 14th day. Okay? They slaughtered the Passover lamb that night. They applied the blood, right? So now it's the daylight hours. They're told to get out of Dodge. So they're going to begin their journey on the daylight hours of that 14th day of Abib, 14th day of Nisan, the Babylonian name, okay? Remember this day in which you come out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out from this place. There shall no leavened bread be eaten. So now we begin that next feast, unleavened bread. This day ye came out in the month Abib. Okay, Exodus 13:4. So notice he tells them here in Exodus 13:1-4, remember this day. You've come out on this day in the month Abib, April. Now, on the civil calendar, that would have been the seventh month, Abib. But in the religious calendar, that cycle, Abib is the first month. And Moses tells them, remember this day. Remember it. Burn it into your minds. And oh, by the way, no unleavened bread shall be found in your tents. Well, that's going to go for 7 days now. The Feast of Unleavened Bread is going to run its course. All right? Now, drop down to verse 6, same chapter. 7 days thou shalt eat unleavened bread, and in the seventh day shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and there shall no leavened bread be seen with thee, neither shall there be leaven with thee within all thy quarters. So we see, we're trying to get our minds here wrapped around this particular events. You got the Passover, you got the slaying of the firstborn in Egypt for those who did not take Moses at his word. They didn't believe what God said, and the firstborn of man and animal, to include in the very palace of Pharaoh, died that night. By the daylight hours, Pharaoh calls Moses and tells him, get out of Egypt, now. And the Israelites spoil the Egyptians, food, wealth, trinkets, gold, silver, all kinds of linen and purple and colored clothing. Remember that? And off they go. And while they're trekking, 7 days, unleavened bread. No leaven found in your pantries and in your tents. So this Passion Week that would become Passion Week in the four Gospels now begins to unfold in Old Testament history. Get the picture? Now, drop down to verse 20, same chapter. And they took their journey from Succoth and camped in Etham in the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by the pillar, by the day, in a pillar of a cloud, led them in the way, and by the night in a pillar of fire to give them light to go by day and night. He took not away the pillar of the cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people. So as you read chapter 13, this week is transpiring as they're trekking out of Egypt. Within those 7 days, what else occurs? Feast of First Fruits. But they can't observe the Feast of First Fruits because there's nothing for them to harvest. But notice the concept. Deliverance in the Passover by the shedding of blood. Unleavened bread to be eaten in these next 7 days. Jesus, the bread of life. And in that same week, while they're trekking out of Egypt, the concept of First Fruits is already implied when God tells them in chapter 13, verse 1, oh, by the way, everything that's born first is mine. God puts his claim on the first fruits of those from the womb. And then eventually he's going to claim the first fruits of the ground. And so right during this week, what do you find transpiring? What type of a gospel message do you find that's being echoed in the opening days of their liberation? Blood redemption, blood atonement, sins covered under the blood. Jesus Christ becomes the bread of life who satisfies my eager and hungry soul. And he is my resurrection and he is my salvation, portrayed in the opening days of the Exodus. Does that happen chance? That is by design. And so for the child of God, when you look at that week when Jesus goes to the cross, he is your Passover, he is your bread, he is your salvation, he is your resurrection. What did Jesus tell Mary and Martha? I am the resurrection. He that believeth in me shall never die. Happen chance? When Jesus uttered those words at the tomb of Lazarus, which was only days leading up to his crucifixion? Do you see how God in the very ministry of Jesus wraps up in this huge salvation bundle the beauty in the parade of days encompassing the initial exodus out of Egypt? Blood atonement. Covered under the blood. Sins atoned for. Sins being addressed. Fallen man being rescued. Jesus, my bread. He is my food. And he's my salvation. And because he rose, I will rise again. Wow. Happen chance? Accidental? No. Plain. But there is another account that is even greater than all of this. Turn to Esther chapter 3. There is another beauty in the unfolding of certain days in the life of Queen Esther. The year is on or around 400 and probably 480, 475 BC time frame. The Babylonian exile is over. In 539 BC, Cyrus the Great conquers Babylon. The last descendant of any Babylonian king, Belshazzar, in Daniel chapter 5, dies that night at the hands of the Persians and the Medes. 536 BC, Cyrus the Great on the throne. God stirs and moves his heart in conjunction with Jeremiah's 70 years of prophecy of exile. The land was going to rest for all the Sabbaths that they neglected. God's land was going to rest for those 70 years. God was going to get back his Sabbath rests, which the Jews cheated him in their neglect of their covenant relationship with him. And he's going to allow as many Jews who want to go back to Jerusalem to rebuild their temple and their city in a great edict that's found in Ezra chapter 1. The individuals who were in charge of carrying out that edict were two men. Zerubbabel, who would be like the governmental representative, and Joshua, the high priest, would have been the representative of the temple complex and the spiritual side of that return. 516 BC, the temple is finished and dedicated, but they had some rough goings. And during that time of rough goings, leading up to the dedication, God sent them, Haggai and Zechariah, to kind of stir the people to get off of their doldrums and get back to finishing up the temple. And in 516, it was dedicated. And then eventually there was a king, a Persian king named Darius the Great, and he wanted to whoop up on the Greeks because his empire was expanding. And now he was knocking on the very door of the Greeks themselves. And he went off with a big army and a big navy, and he came back defeated. While his son, King Xerxes, who is the king on the throne in Esther chapter 1, is his son, and his son wants to save Papa's face. And Xerxes is planning another invasion into the Greeks. Bigger army, bigger navy. And he wanted to go back and avenge his father's defeat that was so humiliating. Well, while all that's going on, there were a lot of Jews in Persia formerly the Babylonian Empire, they didn't go back to the land of their forefathers. They chose to stay in Persia. They were comfortable. They had jobs. They had living. They had livestock. They even had farms. They had homes. They had several generations of kids born and raised in Persia, formerly Babylon. They had no desire to go back. And amongst those people who chose not to go back was a man named Mordecai and a beautiful woman named Esther. Esther, meaning star. And Mordecai was basically her family relative. I forget uncle or cousin, I forget the relationship, but Esther's mom and dad apparently were not on the scene, and so she had another blood relative, this guy named Mordecai, basically being her stepdaddy, taking care of her. And lo and behold, in the opening chapters of the book of Esther, King Xerxes throws this big party bash because he wants to impress people that with his forces, he's going to go back and conquer the Greeks and avenge his father's humiliation. And he calls for his wife, Vashti, to come because she was apparently a very beautiful and attractive woman. And I know that I'm paraphrasing, but I need you to follow along. He calls Vashti to come in and to present herself and to show off her beauty, and she refuses. And that causes a big uproar in this male chauvinistic society. And to make a long story short, Vashti is defrocked. She's removed. Because the other guys were concerned that if their wives saw Vashti, you know, standing up to the king, their male chauvinism is going to have a hard time dealing with that. Their feathers would be ruffled. And so they basically told the king, you need to get rid of her, and which he does. And then after he gets sobered up the next day, he realizes what he's done. And he feels sorry for the queen, but now his advisors say, well, hey, you got rid of her, find yourself a new queen. And so this beauty contest is held all across the Persian Empire, gathering up all these women to go through an extensive year of purification, powder puffing, perfuming, bathing, maybe some court etiquette. And while that's going on, people don't realize in the story, that's when Xerxes goes off. While the beauty pageant, and while they're about to find him a new sweetheart, he goes off to war. And boy, was he humiliated by the Greeks. Oh. Oh boy, he comes home with his tail between his legs. And then you find out in the book of Esther that there's an assassination plot to kill Xerxes. And when you put the timeline together, it makes all the sense. Because when he comes home, he's defeated, can't avenge his papa. Now he got the egg on the face, and apparently there was some rumbling up there in the palace on getting rid of this inept, weak king. And the guy Mordecai, this Jew, who was working in the palace, had a full-time job. He overhears this assassination attempt. It's made known to the king. They do their investigation, and the bozos are killed, and Mordecai is forgotten on his good deed. Well, there was a guy in Mordecai's affairs named Haman, an Agagite. Some translations call him a Gogite, like Gog and Magog of Ezekiel 37:38. Strange. A Gogite. He hated the Jews, especially because of Mordecai. Mordecai didn't greet him, didn't say howdy doody. Mordecai didn't salute. Mordecai didn't give him the time of day. And so these encounters caused Haman to get a real bitter taste about these Jews sprinkled across the Persian Empire. And so in chapter 3, he comes up with this beautiful idea of extinguishing all the Jews in the Persian Empire. Now, look at verse 7 of Esther 3. In the first month, that is the month Nisan. Now, what did I teach you in this lesson? Nisan is Babylonian for what month? Abib, which is what month? April. Springtime. Springtime. What happens in the spring? Passover, unleavened bread, 7 days, feast of first fruits, Abib. In the first month, that is the month Nisan, i.e. Abib, i.e. April, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot, before Haman, from day to day, and from month to month, to the 12th month, that is the month Adar. Now look on your calendar and find out what month is Adar. What month is Adar? Okay. That would be February to March time frame. Okay. So they're casting Pur. What this was some type of divination, or maybe some type with colored rocks or colored stones, just like casting dice, to determine a day in which all of the Jews across the empire would be exterminated. But notice when this casting of lots begins, in the first month, Nisan, which is the month Abib, which corresponds to April, which corresponds to the springtime, the same period where the Passover, 7 days of unleavened bread and first fruits would be observed. They're casting these lots to determine when this killing is going to occur. Haman wants to exterminate all the Jews. He hates the Jews. Mordecai causes this hatred to go full throttle with this guy, Mordecai. Now look at verse 13. And letters were sent by post unto all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women. Notice, underline, in one day. You're going to have a one-day genocide, a one-day liquidation, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, to take the spoil of them for a prey. Wow. So they got the month nailed down on when they're going to do this massive destruction. Okay? And so the letters are sent out. This is a large empire. So they needed the time for all of this huge, extensive postal system which the Persians had. The copy of the writing, and the copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province, verse 14, was published unto all people, that they should be ready against that day. One day. The post went out, being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan the palace, and the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. So, get the picture. Mordecai does a good deed in saving the king's life, but he's forgotten. It's simply recorded, filed, like any government filer, and they simply forget Mordecai. Mordecai goes back to his job. He has these daily encounters with Haman. Haman coming and going, bypassing Mordecai, Mordecai passing by him, and vice versa. No exchange of words, but this overwhelming hatred boiling in this man, Haman. And now he wants to use the power of the empire, the power of the king, to eradicate. Notice what it says, beloved, in that verse 13. Look at that verse 13. Simply liquidate him off the face of the globe and take a spoil. Everything that the Jews own is going to go into the government coffers. Matter of fact, Haman even puts the money up to fund this genocide of this entire people. Versus the king writing off the entire thing, Haman invests a whole lot of money. Now, Haman also had 10 sons. Look at Esther chapter 9, quickly. Esther chapter 9. in verse 12. And the king said unto Queen Esther, the Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men in Shushan the palace, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is thy petition, and it shall be granted thee? Or what is thy request further, and it shall be done? Now, I kind of got a little ahead of myself, but I wanted to show you that Haman had some boys. He had 10 sons. Okay? And once Haman decides what day they're going to do the killing, and now that the letters are being sent out, and everybody in the palace is totally perplexed, why we have this shift towards animosity and avarice and now killing? Remember, the Jews were living comfortably in Persia. The Persians got along with them. They got along with the Persians. And beloved, realize one thing. There's a good possibility that there was intermarrying going on at the same time. Now, while all this is going on, the king comes back. Prior to this edict being made, the king comes back in his defeat. His life is spared. Then that conflict between Haman and Mordecai goes on. Hatred on the part of Haman. Now this decree is signed. While that's going on, Queen Esther, in the beauty contest, she wins. She's beautiful. She's gorgeous. And King Xerxes, King Ahasuerus, he falls in love with her. He's simply starstruck. She's a beauty. But Mordecai tells her, never divulge the fact that you're a Jew. And so that secret stays under the table. All this time that Haman has this decree to kill the Jews. And see, the king signs it. He loves it. Hey, I'm going to get rich out of this. All this booty and all the possessions of these people whom you claim, Haman, are like, you know, bad guys. My coffers are going to explode. And you're willing to put up some of the funding. Win-win on everybody's part. He signs it. Not realizing his beautiful wife Esther, she's a Jew. Well, the king can't go to sleep. So they bring the annals. They bring dry, dusty government paperwork. And somebody is reading to the king, and lo and behold, they read the entry of Mordecai saving his skin. And the king asks, what was done to this poor dude? Nothing, sire. Well, let's do something about it. And the next day, in God's providence, Haman is going to the palace to go meet his boss, right? Maybe have a little wine, a little bread, a little cheese. And as soon as Haman walks in, the king says, Haman, what shall I do to the man that I want to honor? And Haman automatically thinks that it's him. And Haman gives this laundry list of things to do for the man that the king would honor. And then the king tells Haman, go out and do likewise to Mordecai. Oh, beloved, does that rub Mordecai all the more? And while that's going on, Mordecai is building a gallows some 9 feet tall to put Mordecai's neck in that rope and for all to see in the plain of Shinar. Now remember, it's called the plain, right? Which means you can see a 9-foot gallows for quite a while, distance-wise. He wanted to have Mordecai's body swinging on that tree. Now I said all of that not to impress you with my history. But watch what happens in the drama of redemption. Turn to Esther 4. Mordecai finally tells Esther, you got to come clean with the king. You got to tell him that you're a Jew. And she says, well, how about you give me 3 days to pray and to fast? And by the way, I haven't been able to get an audience with this king for the past 30 days. And you know the law of the Persians, that no man can walk into his presence unless he takes that golden scepter and simply points it to them. And if he doesn't point that scepter in your direction, you are toast. Well, with that in mind, look at verse 14. So Esther devises this beautiful plan. Then Mordecai, verse 13 of chapter 4, commanded to answer Esther. Now Esther says, you know, hey, you know, I just can't walk in there. Okay, I haven't been there for 30 days. Now that's God's providence. Mordecai says, think not within thyself that thou shalt escape the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. Well, if you don't do it, Esther, someone else will have to do it. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Then Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer, go, gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days. Mark that. 3 days. Now this is on the heels of what you read way back yonder in Esther 3 and 12, the day in which they were starting to cast those stones to determine the day of execution. Night or day, I also and my maidens will fast likewise, and so will I do unto the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. Chapter 5. Came to pass on the third day, Esther put on her royal apparel, stood in the inner court of the king's house, over against the king's house, and the king sat down upon his royal throne in the royal house, over against the gate of the house. And it was so, when he saw the queen Esther the queen, standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight, and the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in her hand. So Esther drew near and touched the top of the scepter. And as you read the rest of this chapter, he asks her, what do you want? Well, I want to hold the banquet. And he tells Esther, fine. Well, I want Haman to be one of my invited guests. He goes, fine. So that day comes on the scene. Okay, look at chapter 7. So the king and Haman came to the banquet with Esther, the queen. And the king said unto Esther on the second day at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted unto thee. What is thy request? And it shall performed even to the half of the kingdom. Then Esther, the queen, answered and said, if I found favor in thy sight, O king, if it please the king, let my life be given me at thy petition and my people at my request. And then she lets it known. She lets it known that she's a Jew and that Haman's plan is about to sentence her to death along with all of her people. Now, please listen to this. Listen to this quote. A decree was sent out on the 13th of Nisan that all the Jews would be killed. Esther 3:12. Upon hearing this news, Esther proclaims a 3-day fast. Well, that would be Nisan 14 through the 16th. Esther 4:16. On the 16th of Nisan, Esther risked her life when she came to King Ahasuerus. The king asked her, in effect, tell me what you want me to do. Esther says, if it please the king, may the king and Haman come this day at the banquet that I have prepared for him. This would have been the 16th day of Nisan. At the banquet, the king again asked Esther what she wanted. And she asked the king to come to another banquet to be held on the next day. That would have been the 17th of Nisan. On this day, Haman would be hanged. Accident? No. Providential. When Haman was killed, and the plot of Haman was revealed to the king, and what it implied and what it meant and the consequences, a new law was given, allowed the Jews to go out and to defend themselves. But on the 17th day of Nisan, Haman was killed. And by his killing, the nation was allowed to be saved and literally resurrected from genocide in order to bring the Messiah. And then wonder of wonders, when you compare John chapter 12, 23 to 24, and 1 Corinthians 15, verses 16 to 20, Jesus rose on the day starting the feast of first fruits, resurrection and salvation kissing together to bring forth a wonderful plan of redemption, atonement, salvation, deliverance, and the guarantee of your own resurrection behind a long army of other resurrected people, Christ front and center, first fruits of them which slept. Beloved, further proof that all the festivals and the holidays that the nation of Israel was to celebrate and commemorate year after year on their religious cycle calendar is nothing but the gospel in holidays. You have the gospel of the stars, you have the gospel in creation, you got the gospel in the written record. Here is the gospel in festivals. May the name of the Lord truly be praised and blessed. Amen.